On Monday Night Football, the Houston Texans play the Dallas Cowboys. In the NBA, the Bucks were off. The Bulls were hammered by the Houston Rockets, 143-107. Tonight, the Bucks host the Rockets. The Bulls are in Detroit to play the Pistons. The forecast now from the National Weather Service should be cloudy for the day. Dense fog is starting to burn off. And then we'll see some rain move in later this afternoon. Today's high 56. Right now, the wind is calm. It's a cloudy sky, 40 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Over the past 38 years that I have lived here in southeastern Wisconsin, I have been blessed to know some really extraordinary people. And among them, Tom and Lois Von Dahm. Tom, a longtime beloved member of the faculty at Carthage College. Lois, a nurse, very, very active in all kinds of organizations around town. I always enjoyed each and every encounter that I had with Tom and Lois at Carthage events and other events around the community. And because they were both morning show listeners, they often had something appreciative or encouraging to say about the program, which I really appreciated. On November 4th, Lois Von Dahm died at the age of 97. Her husband Tom, her husband of 72 years, was at her side, as was their beloved daughter, Ruth. In memory of Lois and in honor of her, I want to replay for you, in part one of today's morning show, a conversation that I recorded with Lois and Tom some years ago. It actually involved something rather unhappy which befell them. They were willing to come on the morning show to talk about this in the hopes that their story could serve as a cautionary tale for others. I deeply appreciated their generosity then and to this very day. So here is that conversation with Tom and Lois Von Dahm, played in memory of Lois. It's always a pleasure when I can welcome good people, good friends, and devoted listeners into the WGTD studios to be part of the morning show. Although I wish in this particular case it was under, let's say, happier circumstances. But it's a really important story that we're going to be telling in part one of today's morning show. I'm welcoming into the studios today Tom and Lois Von Dahm. And Professor Von Dahm was on the faculty at Carthage College for many, many years. And I have always enjoyed seeing the Von Dahms at all kinds of different events around town. They enrich themselves immeasurably in the cultural landscape of the community and in turn enrich it. And but this time we are talking and doing so on the morning show because of something which happened to the Von Dahms, and they are far from alone. And this is kind of a cautionary tale involving scams over the telephone. They seem to be happening more and more and seem to be happening in more and more sort of sophisticated fashion. That is, the wolf is becoming a whole lot smarter in kind of perpetrating these sorts of crimes. So Tom and Lois are really anxious for this story to be known, and that's why I've extended this invitation to them. So first of all, I welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Glad you're here.
Thank you.
And I know that before we even tell the listeners exactly what happened to you, we should say that this is something about which you obviously don't have pleasant feelings. And I think initially you thought you just do not let anybody know. I wonder if you can just say a word about kind of that journey which you have made between sort of wanting to keep this to yourselves versus feeling like this is a story important to share.
have learned since it happened to us that it has happened to several people. They have been perhaps wiser or more alert than we were, or less touched by the appeal from the scammer, and have not responded the way we did. But since we did, we've learned that so many other people have been approached the same way we are, and they're usually grandparents who are very vulnerable because the call is about a grandchild needing help, needing money. And so now, since we know it's targeted to people just like us, we want the word out, and we're kind of making it our mission to inform people.
That's great. And of course, I think one of the important things you're doing here is it is disavowing a lot of people of the notion that this kind of thing happens, let's say, to foolish people who, you know, make all kinds of mistakes. And, you know, I know both of you well enough to know that you are incredibly intelligent people, and it makes it even more important that this cautionary tale be told, because if this can happen to Tom and Lois Van Damme, it can happen to absolutely anybody.
I can tell you a little about how the trap was sprung. We got a phone call Thursday morning, and the voice over the phone said, "Hi, Grandpa, this is Zach." Now, this is where I think it's not exactly unique, but we have never heard of a case where they actually knew the name of the person who was supposed to be, you know, in trouble.
In other words, you two really have a grandson named Zach.
Right. Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was pretty good. At first I said to him, "This is Zach, your voice sounds a little different," which is understandable. Mm-hmm. He said, "Oh, that was because of the accident that they had been in," excuse me, involving a drunken driver. Of course, it was the other guy's fault. This was, by the way, in Barcelona, Spain, and he said that as a result of the accident, his nose was broken and his lip cut. So that explained the different voice.
Wow.
Boy, they are shrewd and canny and rotten.
Yeah. Rotten for sure, and these other qualities too. Now, so you really have a son named Zach.
A grandson,
yeah. I'm sorry. And did you have some notion that he might be in Barcelona, Spain?
Well, he's in the Air Force, and you know, they get around. Oh, and I guess that's another thing that I should say. He allegedly was in Barcelona as a happy result of, with his buddy. And his buddy and his girlfriend had just broken up before Valentine's Day. Oh, how sad. And so this buddy asked Zach if he could come along.
Mm.
So
this is you who've answered the phone? So
Yes, I was on the phone.
And Lois, were you home at the time?
Absolutely. I in turn talked with Zach, in quotes, and one of my first questions was, "Do you want us to call your folks?" And that is definitely something that the scammer does not want you to do. And so he says, "Do not call my parents. I want to call them myself."
Oh, that was sneaky too, wasn't it?
Yes, and there are red flags. In retrospect, we now have seen red flags that came up. But I've come up with my own term, and it is mind control. That quickly, mind control can take effect because you're thinking with your emotions and you're not thinking rationally.
You're responding to this really
this
is
need,
Zach, and
this
yes,
need.
Absolutely.
He's been in an accident, hit by a drunken driver. He needs money for the insurance, and then the two calls that came after that, they're all asking for money for the medical expenses, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then additional medical expenses. So once we're trapped, we're in it full time. And there's a term that we know now, and Zach has called us immediately after he found out.
The real Zach.
The real Zach, who was safe in California.
Mm.
He's in the Air Force. He does. He's very communicative with his parents. So the minute that we started, when we promised not to tell his folks, but we didn't want to betray his confidence, so we made our daughter promise not to tell him that we had told her. Well, we were only 2 minutes into the conversation, and
she
said,
"This was a Saturday morning.
Yeah,
she
you
had
were
dropped
scammed.
Over at the house.
You were scammed.
Oh,
just like that." And she said, "I'll call Zach right away." So she gets her cell phone out, and calls Zach, and he's safe in California. He's not in Barcelona, Spain. Mm. And his buddy does not have a concussion. And Zach, of course, did not have this profuse nosebleed on Saturday morning that they needed more money for it, for the medical expenses. Very polished.
Yeah.
They're very good at it.
Yes. How many phone calls were there in all from this fake Zach?
Three altogether.
And over what kind of time span?
Friday morning till Saturday morning.
It was just Friday morning and then Saturday morning.
Saturday morning was the last one.
Yeah, the first call was because we needed money because, although the rental car is covered by insurance, and that'll be just a matter of short time, but we do need the money now to pay off the rental car company. That was the second call. Oh, and by the way, I should add that a colleague of the fake Zach was a person who allegedly was from the American Embassy in Barcelona. Of course, I found out later there is no American Embassy.
Mm.
It's in the capital city of Madrid.
Oh,
but
okay.
The thing is, this other fellow then was able to corroborate what Zach had said because that's his job to
of
help
course.
Out Americans, you know, like that. Anyway, so the second call then was for
hospital
money
bills.
For
the hospital.
The hospital, yeah. The insured. And the third call, the emergency call the next morning, of course, was because Zach was experiencing continual nosebleeds and he had to have emergency treatment at the hospital. And he needed money or they couldn't get out of the country.
Now, did you feel your own feelings about this changing over the course of these three phone calls? I mean, was any skepticism creeping in or did you feel sort of equally seized by the scam kind of straight through?
I'll have to say that I hook, line, and sinker right down the line.
But you did, by the third call, I sensed a little skepticism because you said something about this goes on, or words to that effect.
And
it certainly did, but I think he felt after the third call that he had really run us ragged.
Right.
With it.
Well, right. I mean, even if you love your grandson. But that brings up something else, which is, I wonder if you could just speak a word about, well, first of all, do you have any idea where they would have gotten all this information? I know, for instance, Lois, you're on Facebook. Is this likely where that information was come or by other means?
Our daughter immediately felt perhaps it was from Facebook, so as soon as she got home, she went. I'm not that good at Facebook yet. I know how to do some things, but there are certain things I'm not good at. And so she immediately put a privacy, something to deal with the privacy.
Only friends could access
this. I see.
Yes.
Okay.
And that was good. But it was just these other things like, why would he know that it was Zachary? Often they'll just say, this is your grandson. Had he said that, Tom would have been more alert and said, which grandson?
Right.
Zachary, in turn, called us then, as soon as his mom had called him and said, you know, please, you know in the first place, he told us how much he loved us.
Hmm.
I guess just knowing that we would go to that extent for him, and we do love him. And that was one thing I did say to the person from the consulate. I said, you take good care of our Zach. We've loved Zach for 29 years, so you take good care of him. And he said, oh, I will. That's my job.
Oh, boy. But, you know, I'm so glad you said all this, too, because it also seems like they were preying on a very a particular relationship. It seems to me that grandparents often there is this very special relationship in which, first of all, it's sometimes your grandparents to whom you come with things that are too difficult to bring to your parents, and sometimes it's from the grandparents that you can exact certain awkward favors or whatever. But, I mean, there's often a very special kind of generosity without strings attached that is part of grandparent relationships. It sounds like that's part of what was happening here, and it's as though these crooks knew that.
Yeah,
I got to tell you that, well, two things. One is that our daughter, very suspicious right away, is that Zach never withholds information from it. She calls for any little thing.
He calls them.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, and also, I called Western Union afterward because, of course, we couldn't send checks or anything like that. I had to go through Western Union. That leaves no trace, you see.
Sure.
And I called the Western Union Sympathy Line. I don't know what they called it.
Fraud.
But the lady,
the fraud line.
Yeah, the fraud. That's right, the fraud line it was. And so I called the lady, and immediately she said almost to herself, the grandparent scam again.
Oh, dear. So they've lived with this a lot. Lois, you have something else to share?
One thing they do, you asked how many phone calls, they do follow up with a call after you have gone to the bank and took $2,000 out each time and gone to Western Union. Then they, in turn, call you back, and they ask for a 10-digit number. They're so cunning. Mm. And so then you dutifully give them this 10-digit number so they can go and collect the money from Western Union.
Isn't that nice?
Wow. So we have about a minute left. So what is, aside from sharing the story, which I think in and of itself is very powerful and tremendously helpful, do you have any further advice you want to give to people that otherwise might be potential targets for this in the future? What would your advice be?
Before you send anything, check everything.
Before you send anything, check everything.
Yes.
And another thing that our grandson said for us to do is anytime now, he put this on Facebook too, anytime that someone calls and says it's him, ask what my first dog's name was. And if they can't tell you that, they don't know Zach.
Wow.
So if you have a clue,
that's good. Mm-hmm. You know, your real grandson, Zach, is a smart young man. He's as smart as his grandparents. And altogether, I'm so glad you're sharing this story with the public. It's so important. Tom and Lois Van Damme, thank you for doing this. And I suspect that you have done a very, very good deed today that'll make a difference in the lives of others who will avoid this unpleasantness in their own lives. So
thanks for providing the opportunity.
Thank you.
That's why we're here. Our thanks to Tom and Lois Van Damme. The preceding interview with Tom and Lois Van Damme was recorded and initially broadcast some years ago. We replayed it today in memory of Lois Van Damme, who passed away on November 4th at the age of 97. She will be missed by all who knew and loved her. I'm Gregory Berg. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Speaking of extraordinary people I've been blessed to know over the last several decades, towards the very top of the list is Norm McPhee, who served the Racine Theatre Guild with great distinction as its managing and artistic director for 32 years. Upon his retirement from that position in the spring of 2001, Norm McPhee went on to guest direct a number of productions at the Guild, the last being in 2016. Next week, we're going to be airing a tribute to Norm McPhee, in which a number of people who had the pleasure and privilege of working directly with him will reminisce about that experience. In the meantime, I thought today it would be interesting to replay a portion of the conversation that I recorded with Norm McPhee back in the late spring of 2001, just as his tenure as managing and artistic director of the Theatre Guild was coming to a close. I'm replaying this conversation today in his memory.
We're talking with Norm McPhee, who is managing artistic director of the Racine Theater Guild, has been that for 32 years, but that tenure is about to come to an end. Your official last day with the Theater Guild?
I think is June 30.
Hmm. You get to put up your feet and relax then on the 1st of July. We want to talk a little bit about your tenure with the Racine Theater Guild. And I suppose one of the things we could maybe begin with is the phenomenon of musicals and the fact that once upon a time they were not a familiar, frequent staple in the Theater Guild's repertoire. And, of course, now it's something that the whole community really looks forward to, and it's a real mainstay of what you do. When did they kind of enter the picture?
Well, when I first came to Racine in 1969 and assumed the position of managing artistic director, I was told that we needed to do at least one musical a year. And I looked at the box office receipts for the previous 10 years or whatever at time, and I could see that the musical's cost was number one in all the shows, and they were generally running fourth or fifth in attendance. And I said, that isn't very good, because you really need a lot of strong horses to pull a musical. And I was a little skeptical of that, and especially the first 2 years that I was here, we did musicals, and they were okay. They were smaller musicals, and we didn't set the world afire with those. And so I said, well, let's just try doing some seasons without musicals. Not to say that we won't ever do them again, but we will just take a little hiatus from doing musicals for a period of time. And we did. We went, five, six, 7 years without doing a musical, and then we sort of eased them back in. We started doing one every so often and or a play with music or something like that. And as the popularity became more interesting, we began to examine that as a part of our regular staple of things that we do. And I think the first really big turnaround was Peter Pan, when we did that. And that was about 10 years ago, I guess now 10 or 11 years ago, that we presented Peter Pan. And that was such a smashing success. And it was so difficult. Why we picked that musical, I don't know, because technically it was very difficult with all the flying and things that had to be done on our stage. Again, our stage is not really very adaptable to some of those things. And so with the success of that show, why we began to look at doing something on a pretty regular basis. And from there it went to doing probably a small musical in the summer and then a larger musical in the holiday season. And then we got to the point where some years we had three musicals in there. And we know now that they're going to be successful for us if we can put together a good show with a good cast. We'll do well with them.
When you started back in 1969, how long a season were we talking about?
We did five plays. Did five plays on three weekends.
So that sort of core of the season, that really hasn't changed too much. Your regular season is still five shows.
No, it is five shows. After I'd been in Racine several years, why I added a summer show in when we were at the old theater on High and Erie Street. But the summer show was always kind of scary because we never knew how hot it was going to be, and that place was not air conditioned, and sometimes it was unmercifully hot in that converted church, and then the people wouldn't come because it was just too miserable in there to sit and watch a show for a couple of hours. And It took us a while to figure out how to add more shows in the season. We came to the new theater in 1976, and we right away added an extra weekend of shows. Started out first with just a couple of performances, eventually four performances on a fourth weekend. And then we started to toy with the idea of a summer show. And we didn't start the summer shows until 1980. And we started that with old-time melodrama. And we did that for several years and found out that they were reasonably successful. And from there, we went into doing something a little more elaborate and generally a musical, and just made things work. And our first really successful summer musical, I think, was Do Black Patent Leather Shoes Really Reflect
That? Oh, yeah, I remember that. Mm-hmm. So that was fun. So while the rest of the world kicks back and relaxes, people at the Racine Theater Guild were working harder than ever.
Yes, harder than ever. And then I guess after we had the summer show fairly established, I had always been told someplace in my education that a dark theater earns nothing. And it isn't good for it to be dark. And so we began to experiment with doing what I term bonus plays, where we added additional plays in the season, played them shorter length of time, allowed the season tickets holders to buy the tickets at their season ticket rate. And that became a very successful program. We then increased our season from 5 to 8 shows. And now, of course, we have the children's theater in there too, so now we're doing 12 shows a season.
Mm. So it's a busy, 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 busy place.
Yes, we don't have many free weekends there.
Right. When you started in 1969, how would you characterize the repertoire of the Theater Guild then versus what it is now? I mean, were you essentially giving the community the same sorts of theatrical literature as you are now?
No, I think that primarily then the seasons were made up largely of what I would call typical community theater fare. That is primarily the American domestic comedy.
Mm.
And
lighter and fluffier.
Lighter and fluffier stuff. And there's nothing wrong with that, of course. But we have continued to try to challenge ourselves a little beyond that. We do a lot of different things that I'm just thinking, for instance, of Communicating Doors that we did this past spring, an Alan Ayckbourn play, and how most amateur theaters, most volunteer theaters, wouldn't touch that play with a 10-foot pole, and yet we did quite well with the show.
Remind me again what that was about?
It was about the, it was a time travel play where people went forward and backward in time. An older man had asked or engaged a young prostitute to come to his hotel room for the purpose of confessing to her the murder of his two wives. And they went somehow they go through a closet door, and they went backwards and forwards in time. The play was set in 2014, the year 2014, and it went back to 1974, yeah, that's right. It was 20 years difference in each segment, and how this girl was able to change the course of history by going in this time travel thing. They changed it so he didn't murder his two wives. They both lived normal lives. And a very, very unusual and interesting play. And I just think that that's some of the things that we do that not many many theaters of type would go into.
Right. I think of that play called Sylvia, wasn't it?
Yes.
Where it's one of the main characters is a dog, and it's played by a person.
Yes.
very different yes. sorts of things.
And that was a very successful venture for us, too. I mean, we just, we are not really afraid to push the envelope a little bit. We haven't gone really way out yet, but perhaps that will come along someplace in the future.
Well, and of course, one of the interesting things about the theatrical community in southeastern Wisconsin right now is that there are a couple of other companies that actually are sort of exist for the purpose of pushing the envelope,
yes.
and so
yes.
it allows the Theater Guild to not feel so compelled
to push on that too much.
Right. Nonetheless, I bet it was not necessarily the easiest thing in the world to move the Theater Guild in that direction. I mean, away from the familiar comforts of you can't take it with you and familiar old favorites like that to challenge both company and audience.
Yes, and I think that it was, when I came, it was a community theater like most of the others. It was basically a club where people came to socialize. Not necessarily did they, was the art element the foremost thing that was on their mind. The socialization was probably the most important, although it had changed a little bit away from that by the time I came. But I've always tried to get people to think in terms of we want to look at the play, and the play is the thing that we're doing. The rest of the stuff comes just because we're there, but the play is the important thing that we deal with.
So how did you go about effecting that change? I mean, that sort of more serious and professional approach to all of this, or did you just step up onto a soapbox and give some sermonettes? And
no, I think I tried to, if anything, I probably tried to lead with or push in that direction with some kind of an example. You know, I'd come from a fairly professional background, and I believed that the theater could do those things and be disciplined, and we could do show some good artistic effort in the things that we did, knowing, of course, that we wouldn't have the kind of funding available to us that a fully blown professional theater would have. But we had some tools, and we had some people that were really interested in the art and developing themselves into good players and excellent technicians to do some of the things that we do.
Remind us of what the home of the Theater Guild was like when you came in 1969. Where was the home base at that point?
It was on the corner of High and Erie Street. It was a converted Bohemian Catholic church.
Oh, that's right.
It had been built originally in 1896 and had gone through several changes. It had been a Turner Hall, which was a fraternal organization. They held wedding receptions and parties and whatnot there. And then before the Theater Guild took it over in 1953, it was the home of the Racine Racing Pigeon Club, which was always my favorite. And they had installed, so the story goes, they had put a loft in that church to recover and launch the pigeons. And that became almost a perfect stage house for scenery to be moved up and down and flown in and out. And so when I came, they had already refurbished the theater and changed that church into, in its own way, a very charming Victorian-style theater.
Hmm. Is this the place where the lighting booth was actually like down another level?
Well, initially, they had changed that just before I came. It used to be in the basement of the theater where the lighting operator couldn't see the stage, and where they had these old rheostatic dimmers that you've had, big handles, you know, and you moved whole. You moved either one single dimmer, or you locked them all together, and you moved a ton of electrical component all at the same time. To create the dimming effects. I never could imagine how that worked, but it did. When I came, they had just put in a new lighting system, and the light booth was the small little room right off the lobby, and the lobby was not giant sized, it was very small lobby, and this lighting booth was in there, and I know we used to have the sound operator, the lighting operator, and occasionally myself in that lighting booth, and we were closer than shoulder to shoulder. And we were so jammed into this little space, there was hardly room to move. But we did a number of shows there, and when they received that new lighting system, they were able to make all kinds of special things happen that they'd never been able to do before. And one of the other things that I remember very distinctly is the theater had a raked stage when I came there. And a raked stage is an interesting thing because of slopes, but in order to make the raked stage really work, you have to saw the furniture's legs and everything else so it's all in proper perspective when it was out there on the stage. Well, they didn't have the money to do all those kind of things, so one of the first things I did was I said, let's level the stage. Let's not play with a raked stage because it's too difficult to get the right effect with that stage. And so we did. We leveled the stage, and we played with the level stage for the rest of our time from 1969 till 1976 when we left.
By the way, is anything in that building? I know that building still stands.
It's the last I knew. I don't go by there very often, but the last I knew it was a church again.
Oh.
And for Hispanic congregation.
Interesting. Well, the new home of the Theater Guild, that had to be an absolutely thrilling undertaking.
It was.
To be part of something, and where at least to some extent you could have a real hand in designing exactly the kind of theater that you thought the Theater Guild needed.
Well, it was probably the most exciting event of my life in the theater, was to build that theater and to decide what kind of a theater it was going to be. When I came to Racine, I'd just come from an arena stage in California, and I like the fluidity of the arena stage.
What does that mean?
Where the audience sits all the way around the stage.
Like theater in the round.
Around,
okay.
Yes.
I never heard it called that before.
And so I had, I was very interested in that kind of stage because I thought it gave such endless possibilities to the imagination and also to movement in the theater. And we began to look at a variety of stages, and some the traditional proscenium stage, some theater in the round, and we got interested in the thrust stage a little later in the whole process. But I know we went to some of the people who put up much of the early money for the Theater Guild, and we asked them what their feeling was, and almost to a person, they said that they, if we were going to do something, we should do something that was very unique and ours, and not the regular type of theater that everybody would, that every community would have. And so that's how we came into being with the thrust stage. We visited all the major thrust stage theaters in this country, and we even at one time had as a fundraising effort, we were going to get the rehearsal stage from the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis. They were going to give us a rehearsal stage that they had to put in and drop in our theater as the main stage. But
wow.
We decided that became too costly of an effort to move it from Minneapolis to Racine. Mm. We could build one cheaper than we could move the rehearsal stage. And so, although it was kind of a neat idea in the beginning, it became an impossible idea as we went along. So we ended up building our own. And it, I think it has served us very well. Sometimes sometimes it's a very difficult stage to work with because of its shape. We have no orchestra pit, as you are well familiar with. We have no trapping on the stage. In other words, we have no hydraulics so we can take things up and down. So we out of, through the stage floor proper, and so we have to be quite clever and creative if we're going to do double levels or change scenery or all of those kind of things.
You know, the other thing that occurs to me is because it is a thrust theater and you're right out there in the midst of the audience, not very much gets hidden. I mean, there's not a bad seat in the house in the sense that none of us feel like we're a long way from the stage, but then by the same token, you're sort of challenged as the director to make everything just as real as possible because there isn't anything that's going to get kind of lost in the murkiness.
No, there are very few things that you can hide, including starting right with the makeup on the actors' faces. You know, it doesn't take very much to make it look very phony when they're wearing makeup. And the stage props, anything that the actors are using, you know, have to be fairly believable or the audience won't buy into it because they are so close to it. And yet I think that's the thing that I like the most is that the actors are right in with the audience and make them part of the action almost. And that I think is the real advantage of the thrust stage.
Of course. I hadn't thought about the issue until several years ago, actually. Interviewing Lisa Kronetsky from UW Parkside about their production of Romeo and Juliet, and they did it apparently in a setting that sort of resembled a thrust, and she called it a kind of a mistake on her part. She had staged one of the deaths or murders in Romeo and Juliet to be far downstage, right in the heart of the audience, and as soon as she sort of started realizing it in the last rehearsals, she realized she'd put this really crucial thing right down there where it's so you saw every detail, and it became literally a matter of life and death for the production to make that work, which, you know, she said it did work very well. But I'd never stopped to think about that a director, given some situations, would actually take tricky things and try to put them sort of out of easy sight of the audience. And you don't have that at the Racine Theatre Guild. You have to make everything work because we see everything.
You do. And you know, there used to be a formula on the proscenium stage. I'm thinking of Alexander Dean, who was one of the great teachers of directing in the American theater. I think of his book where he was talking of the various areas of the stage that are used for certain purposes. You know, and he was speaking of the proscenium stage. Well, as we've been talking, you can't, if you put your death scenes up left, why, there's plenty of audience up left in our theater, so yeah. You can't really hide any of that. You have to have it fairly real.
Of course, that does make it a marvelously immediate kind of
yes.
experience. And I was even thinking, I can think back to a number of different occasions, too, where the way it's set up makes it possible for entrances to happen through the audience or for actors to come out into the audience in ways that you just couldn't possibly do in a more conventional sort of theater. I mean, the action can really come right up into the audience without much trouble at all and
can
be very effective.
Without any trouble at all. You know, we just prior to West Side Story, we were doing the complete works of William Shakespeare, and they had the actors in and out of the audience all the time in that show. And then as we're talking, I'm thinking about the two rumble sequences in West Side Story where the fights occur and where we have the fights going right against the audience all the time in there, where people are throwing themselves against the railing that separates the stage from the audience, and how they really have to feel like people are going to land right in their laps, that they're right in the midst of the action.
Wow. I was thinking, looking back on all that the Theater Guild and you have accomplished, was reminded of something that Jerry Smith said on a morning show interview that I thought was so profound This was at a time, she is head of the Racine United Arts Fund, mm-hmm. which, of course, benefits the Theater Guild, among other organizations. And in talking about Ruoff one time in the morning show, Jerry pointed out something that had never occurred to me before, the fact that a city the size of Racine, or a city the size of Kenosha, for that matter, is a perfect size in the sense that when you have a real flagship organization like the Racine Theater Guild, it's in a community large enough that you can really achieve marvelous excellence. I mean, great, great things. And yet the city is small enough that the people who participate are really integral to it. I mean, and this is a small enough community where regular old volunteers step forward and can have the leading role in whatever this play happens to be. And of course, you get to a city like the size of Milwaukee, and all of a sudden you're talking about a whole different kind of theater where the dentist down the street does not get to be Hamlet or whoever. And I had never stopped to think about that, but that really is, I think, absolutely true. And says a lot about the success of the Racine Theater Guild over the years, that it's achieved great artistic things, and it's achieved it with regular people from right down the street.
Yes, and those regular people that just stay with us for years and years and years and years and years. I'm thinking of Jim Yorgan, who's playing Doc in West Side Story.
And very well.
83-year-old man out there on stage doing his turn as he's done. Jim stopped me the other night as we were talking before the show, and he said, you know, this is the 24th show that we've done together, which means that we've been pretty close to doing one a year for the time that I've been here.
Wow.
And that's always amazing to me, that the people who come back, who continue to participate year in and year out, and see them grow artistically and the things that they do and the things that they're capable of doing.
Hmm.
Norm McPhee served as managing and artistic director of the Racine Theater Guild for 32 years, stepping down from that position in the late spring of 2001. Norm McPhee passed away earlier this month at the age of 88. And next Monday, the 25th of November, we're going to be airing a tribute to Norm McPhee, in which a number of people who had the pleasure and privilege of working directly with him will reminisce about the experience. Please join us for that special morning show next Monday, the 25th of November, right here on WGTD. Tomorrow on the morning show, Dr. Art Sear will be paying his monthly visit to the program to offer his analysis of current events and issues. We'll get his thoughts as well on the recent election. On Wednesday, one of my guests will be Captain Eddie Williams, who is from the local chapter of the Salvation Army. Their Red Kettle fundraising campaign is soon to be underway, and we will be talking with him about that. On Thursday, we will be previewing the next production of the UW Parkside Theater Department, an interesting-sounding play called Hand to God. It tells the story of a Texas youth who has just lost his dad and is struggling to fit in, and he ends up joining his mother's puppet ministry at their church and sort of trying to find his way in the world. And things go into a very unexpected direction when the puppet he uses in that ministry begins to take on a life of its own. And we'll be talking about that intriguing play on Thursday. The play opens this coming weekend. On Friday, we talk politics with Robert Creamer, who has been an activist and campaign worker for decades and has written a very interesting book called Nuts and Bolts. And It talks about the way in which campaigns are run in the 21st century, what it takes to succeed, and he'll offer his thoughts on this most recent presidential election. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. And by the way, for those of you who enjoyed hearing a bit from Norm McPhee of the Racine Theater Guild today, that interview from 2001 in its entirety is available on the podcast from this past Saturday. To subscribe to the Morning Show podcast, look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Today is going to be cloudy with rain developing this afternoon with a high of 56 degrees. Tonight, cloudy, windy, and rainy, a low of 54, and rainy tomorrow as well as we warm up to a high of 63. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.